You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Moncler. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio 2 in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes... In Hamas-controlled Gaza, Fatah throws itself an enormous birthday party. We'll be wondering whether this signals a definitive end to hostilities between Palestine's own Judean People's Front and People's Front of Judea. Also ahead, Al Jazeera stakes a claim on the American market with the purchase of floundering cable channel Current TV. Will America respond favourably to Al Jazeera's peerless coverage of the Middle East, or is Al Jazeera America doomed to spend most of its time and energy trying to justify itself? In China, the country's chronic disinterest in copyright reaches an exciting new apotheosis. An unauthorized replica of a vast and ambitious new project by Dame Zaha Hadid looks set to host its opening night party before the original. We'll explain how.
There's no way you could possibly tell the difference between the two, which is really stunning and kind of shows how adept China has become at this copying.
And as Staten Island continues its post-Sandy clear-up, confirmation that efforts to build the world's tallest Ferris wheel amid the wreckage will continue. An act of admirable American can-do or fate-tempting folly? I'll ask the borough's president. All that, plus a consideration of the enticing possibility that everything we think is wrong, plus music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all of that, the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Médecins Sans Frontières, the international human rights and medical organisation, warned today of a silent crisis in the Central African Republic as people in the capital Bangui nervously wait to see if the advancing rebels reach their city. Ellen van der Velden, the head of the Dutch branch of MSF, said since both rebels and the government have agreed to peace talks, some people have begun returning home, though she was unsure what kind of services they would return home to.
In the north of the country, many cities have been taken over by the rebels. During the time of the takeover, many of the population were forced to flee to escape hostilities. So people have spent time in the bush, sleeping there. What we see now is that gradually the people are coming back to their homes, but obviously all kinds of services that they had before in these places have been disrupted.
Here, a former pub landlord from West Yorkshire has become the first person in Britain to have a hand transplant. Mark Cahill from Halifax had lost the use of his right hand because of gout. The eight-hour operation took place at Leeds General Hospital on the 27th of December. He was pleased with the result.
Hopefully I'll be able to get back to work for a start. That's a major difference. For a start, I might be able to cut my food up, button my shirt, fasten a pair of shoelaces, and mainly I'll be able to hold my grandson's hand. I'm getting slight movement now. My feelings just started to come back, but everything's looking very, very good. It's doing well.
Well, his surgeon, Professor Simon Kay, said he was making good progress.
I think Mark's got a very strong chance of regaining good function. He had a functionless hand before. He had no function in it at all. Over the next 6 months to a year, we expect to see recovery of feeling, recovery of movement, recovery of power. I'd be very disappointed if that didn't happen. I strongly believe it will.
Italian police have arrested a young mafia boss in Naples. They arrested 28-year-old Antonio Manetta, considered to be the boss of the Girati, a group of the Neapolitan Camorra mafia, during a large-scale operation. Nepal held its eighth day of anti-rape protests today in a movement that has mirrored neighbouring India and is demanding protection against rape. President of women's NGO Sathi Bandana Rana joined the demonstration in the capital Kathmandu.
There has been an increasing incidences of violence right in the capital city also. And some women have been raped, some women have been burnt alive. Even security personnel and legal authorities have been involved in such crime. So what we are gathered here to say, enough is enough.
Members of a British team were today getting ready to fly to Burma to search for MK-14 Spitfires, believed to have been buried at the end of the Second World War. Specialist conflict lead archaeologist Andy Brockman thinks up to 20 of the famous planes were interred in 1945.
It is probably one of the most unusual and intriguing projects I've ever been involved with. It's a fascinating mystery. It's one of the great mysteries of World War II as to where this story of buried aeroplanes came from. It's been current since virtually the time it's supposed to have happened.
And finally, a nationwide heat wave in Australia has led to record-breaking temperatures and an outbreak of bushfires in several states. Vast swathes of central and southeastern Australia were sweltering as temperatures in the outback hit 48 degrees Celsius, that's 118 Fahrenheit. The average temperatures across the country was 39 Celsius, 102 Fahrenheit. In the South Australian capital, Adelaide, temperatures exceeded 45 degrees, while in Hobart in Tasmania, it had a peak of 41.8, its highest temperature in 120 years of record keeping. And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. That is indeed astonishing for Hobart, less so for Adelaide, where summers in high January, as I know from many personal experiences, can often clear 40 Celsius. But that is obviously terribly worrying news for people in Victoria and New South Wales, especially in bushfire country. Fingers crossed for them. It's 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio 2 on Monocle 24 in London. Now, not so long ago, Hamas-controlled Gaza would have seemed as likely to open a museum celebrating the life and works of Ariel Sharon as it would be to host a party organised by Fatah. The two Palestinian factions fell out violently in June 2007 and fought something very like a civil war for control of Gaza, a brief and bitter struggle eventually won by Hamas, after which Fatah's name was spoken in whispers in the enclave, at least until the two groups signed a reconciliation accord in 2011. Today, however, hundreds of thousands of Fatah supporters have turned out in Gaza to rally celebrating the 48th anniversary of the foundation of the movement. Well, joining me now to guide us through the ramifications is Monocle's Ramallah correspondent, Joseph Dana. Joseph, are you surprised by the scale of these celebrations?
Well, I think the images coming out of Gaza of this, you know, this kind of sea of yellow flags are quite surprising indeed. I mean, just as you mentioned, you know, a couple of years ago, this would be absolutely unheard of. But underneath what's going on with this, you know, kind of very strong showing of Fatah is the kind of splintering of the Palestinian kind of body politic. I think that the Fatah rally really signifies the fact that a lot of people in Gaza are not necessarily as kind of enamored with Hamas's leadership as we might think coming off of the Gaza war. And so it's surprising and it's not surprising at the same time.
Obviously, Fatah's supporters in Gaza have had to be fairly circumspect the last few years in particular, but who are they and how do they differ, whether politically, socially, economically, from Hamas supporters?
Well, Hamas is governing the territory, and so, you know, the Fatah supporters are not necessarily as underground as we might think. While Hamas is governing the territory and administering what's going on, the Fatah backbone, as it were, is still very much alive in Gaza, and they come from a variety of different backgrounds. Now, they're not necessarily hardline kind of Islamic supporters like those that are championing the Hamas movement, but they do exist and they do get a very important paycheck at the end of the month from the Palestinian Authority, which has continued to pay salaries in Gaza throughout this kind of crisis, this almost civil war that's been unfolding.
I mean, in general, I mean, this does follow, which was almost as interesting, a Hamas rally on the West Bank last month. How are the two factions getting on in general at the moment?
Yeah, well, this is exactly the most kind of interesting aspect of this, that we see Fatah rallies in Gaza, which is the Hamas-led kind of territory, and we see kind of resurgent Hamas rallies in the West Bank, which is led by Fatah. And so I think that this is a very clear sign that a lot of Palestinians are not necessarily confused about which party they support, but definitely kind of at odds with their kind of governing party. If you're living in the West Bank under Fatah, you know, you're a little bit more inclined to see a Hamas rally or maybe even support Hamas rally, you know, in the streets as a kind of demonstration of a little bit of, you know, I would say kind of upset with the way that things are going. And so I think what's going to be very fascinating with this Fatah rally and, you know, these dramatic photos coming out is how the leading people in charge, Ismail Haniyeh and Abbas, are going to use this for their own political gain as we move forward and possibly closer to a reconciliation agreement.
I mean, do you think the relations between Hamas and Fatah have been affected in any way by the recent semi-recognition of Palestine by the United Nations, whether that's, I guess, reminded them that they're in theory at least on the same side?
It's hard to say whether or not it's brought the reconciliation closer or the fact that they're on the same side, but definitely the United Nations statehood bid, as well as the perceived Hamas victory over Israel during the last kind of Gaza flare-up, has pushed both sides into a position of relative kind of power. They're feeling resurgent. They're feeling as though they're, you know, they can kind of command the Palestinian street. And so I think that's why we're starting to see a little bit more push towards reconciliation, because at the same time, while they feel insurgent, you know, Abbas in Ramallah and the Hamas leadership in Gaza City, while they're feeling insurgent, they're also, you know, suspect of this very kind of volatile street and the region. And so I think we're going to actually see in the beginning months of 2013 a real push towards concrete reconciliation, which would have really dramatic effects regionally if it was to kind of take hold in Palestine.
I mean, how unified or indeed reconciled a country or semi-country does Palestine feel now? I mean, it's been a while since I've personally set foot in Gaza or the West Bank. It's 6 or 7 years since I last visited both of them. But even then, they felt like extremely different places for all sorts of reasons. How, I guess, what's the extent of the divergence between them now?
Well, it's definitely, you can definitely feel it. It's palpable in Gaza and in the West Bank. But what I've noticed over the last couple of months, and I've included this in a lot of reporting for Monocle, is this kind of feeling among Palestinians that they don't really like Fatah or Hamas. You know, I recently did a piece during a Hamas rally in Nablus, which was a very significant event for the West Bank. And one gentleman, a shop owner, basically said, you know, we don't need either one of these parties. We need the United Nations or some sort of international body to govern this territory. So there really is this deep, deep fatigue, which leads to a certain kind of cynicism in Palestine. The question is really whether or not that cynicism can be kind of bridged through a reconciliation agreement or through some sort of new life in, you know, the Palestinian struggle. And this is an ongoing debate in Palestine, armed struggle versus unarmed struggle, and how this is going to go forward. And so the Egyptians and the rest of the region could, you know, maybe play a role in bridging some of this frustration. But right now, I would say it's a pretty depressing snapshot.
Joseph Tana, our Ramallah correspondent, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back after this to examine the launch of Al Jazeera America.
Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
Home to almost every alpine cliché you can imagine, Switzerland's remote Lower Engadine has its own brand of old-fashioned charm. Monocle's film crew put on their snow boots to capture a world lost in time.
In earlier times, there was a clear hierarchy in the village. First of all came the priest, then the teacher, then the blacksmith. The one who controlled the fire, actually the master of the fire, that was then, in the belief of the people, a bit a higher person.
Mountain magic on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, the purchase of Current TV by Al Jazeera is much more interesting than the acquisition of a struggling American cable channel by a wealthy Middle Eastern news network might normally be. The takeover has prompted one of those shrill eruptions of pantomime name-calling in which the US media specializes. To hear some summaries of the deal, you might surmise that Current's founder, former Vice President Al Gore, has sold America's airwaves to the heirs of Osama bin Laden. This, at least, is certainly the view taken by Fox News, almost as if Fox's parent company wasn't partially owned itself by a nephew of the King of Saudi Arabia. Current will be known henceforth as Al Jazeera America. And joining me now to discuss what this might mean for Al Jazeera and America is Greg Mitchell of The Nation, who has been following the story. Greg, first of all, how entrenched in America is this idea that Al Jazeera is the broadcasting arm of Al Qaeda?
Well, it's pretty entrenched going back to really the 1990s, and then, of course, even more so after September 11th. You know, there's been some breakdown of that in recent years because more Americans and more media commentators and public officials have actually got a chance to see some of the coverage more via the web, mainly. It's not really on many cable networks in the U.S. at all. It's very hard for anyone anywhere to actually watch it on the tube. They can watch it online, and they have seen in recent years, you know, some pretty terrific coverage of the Arab Spring and the revolt in Egypt and so on. So there have been some media commentators, some politicians who have said, yes, actually their coverage of the Middle East is, you know, is pretty fair and balanced. But nevertheless, you'd still have to say that the vast majority of Americans and media figures continue to spin it as anti-America and anti-Israel and so forth.
Is there anything Al Jazeera can actually do about that, or is it best advised to just go about doing what it does well, which, as you say, is it's absolutely excellent coverage of the Middle East?
Right. Yeah, probably. Probably they should just do their thing. I think their first goal is to get on these cable networks. We've already seen a dust-up with Time Warner Cable, one of the biggest outfits here, which immediately canceled its current deal and threw into question whether it would pick up Al Jazeera. After a flood of complaints, they're now backing down a bit and saying they're open to carrying Al Jazeera. But we'll see how the others react. I think the most current information today or analysis today is that Al Jazeera America may have to do what Murdoch did with Fox News at the beginning, which is pretty much give away the content at first, or even in some cases pay the huge cable networks to cover it, to carry it, and then as time goes on, it will establish itself, and then, you know, maybe start to make money. But that is they do theoretically have enough money to do that, and I suppose that's the fallback plan.
Well, that is exactly the advantage Al Jazeera have over many other media organizations in that money is not necessarily a problem for them. If they do manage to establish themselves in the United States, which American news networks might have most to fear from Al Jazeera? Who would they be taking viewers from?
Well, of course, it would be the major cable news networks here, MSNBC, CNN, and Fox. I don't know how many will abandon Fox. But, and then you have the business channels here. I suppose PBS to some extent. I think it's, you know, none of these, even Fox does not have a gigantic audience. You're talking about numbers, you know, 500,000 here, 1 million there, 2 million there. I suppose they could carve out a steady, strong, regular viewership. I think more likely they would get large numbers as there are crises in the Middle East that the Americans care about, and that maybe that's enough for them. But I think I think the biggest threat, if you want to call it that, is that all the cable news networks, when there's a big crisis or just ongoing coverage of Israel and Palestine. You know, invariably either semi-ignore it or, 95% of the time refuse to really criticize Israel. So it's sort of even MSNBC, which is seen as the more liberal network, rarely has much coverage really critical of Israel. They prefer to be silent in most cases. So I suppose Al Jazeera, which may present a more balanced or even a more critical view of Israel, would be a threat to, you know, sort of like, oh, people could watch that and say, oh, gee, I haven't really been exposed to that, or why haven't I been exposed to that, or why, you know, why am I getting that here? It seems fairly credible. What's with the other networks?
There was, of course, at least one other buyer interested in Current, which is reportedly Glenn Beck. The imagination boggles when trying to consider what a Glenn Beck-led news network would look like. What happened there, as far as anyone knows?
Well, I'm not sure we've gotten the full story. My take would be that maybe Glenn Beck was interested. Maybe he did make this call. Maybe he was turned away quickly, partly for political reasons. But, you know, every analysis sort of says today, say that Al Jazeera, if anything, overpaid for Current TV. They supposedly paying $500 million. And it, as you said, it boggles the mind that Glenn Beck would have $500 million at his disposal. So, you know, it's possible that politics was somewhat involved, but it may have been that, you know, Al Gore or Current TV kind of laughed knowing that Glenn Beck was not in the ballpark in any kind of offer.
Al Gore, it seems, can certainly afford to laugh now all the way to the proverbial bank. Greg Mitchell of The Nation, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. Now, it will not come as news to anyone involved in the production or distribution of music and cinema, or the technology they're played on, that China has little interest in the niceties of copyright. The People's Republic often gives the impression of being nothing so much as a vast bootlegger's workshop, ripping off the rest of the world's ideas as fast as the rest of the world can have them. Even by Chinese standards, however, the piracy of an entire building is ambitious, but that's exactly what appears to be happening in Chongqing, where developers are erecting a replica of a new edifice designed by Dame Zaha Hadid in Beijing. It's not the first time the Chinese have gone in for architectural forgery. They famously built a complete replica of the Swiss village of Hallstatt, among many others. But what's different about this theft is that the original building is not yet complete. And on Current form, the ribbon on the fake may be cut first. Earlier, Emma Nelson spoke to our Singapore correspondent Justin Bergman and pondered the obvious question of how these plans could have been stolen so quickly.
That's the big question, isn't it? I don't think anybody's sure of what's happening over in Chongqing, where the fake Zaha Hadid building is going up. But apparently some of the plans were secreted out in some way, and it's believed that maybe the architects got a hold of some digital files or some renderings of the project, something that would allow them to at least copy the outside shape of the building. Now, you know, who knows what it looks like actually close up or inside, if it has any resemblance whatsoever to the original.
Do we have any idea how close a copycat this is, from the outside at least?
Well, from the outside, I mean, it looks remarkably similar. There's no way you could possibly tell the difference between the two, which is really stunning and kind of shows how adept China has become at this copying, which, you know, you find in every single facet of society there. In fact, there's a word for it called shanzai, which you hear everywhere in China. And when you're shopping, you always have to make sure you're getting a real product or the shanzai product. You don't want the fake product.
Justin, tell us a little bit more about this copycat culture in China. We have architecture, we have towns. I know in Monocle 24 we've done the Austrian village of Hallstatt that's been copied brick for brick and sent over to China. And we also have the everyday life copycatting of the likes of Apple.
Yeah, and I went out for another Monocle radio piece to a small little village outside of Shanghai called Thamestown, which is a replica of a small English village, which has copied everything from the streets to the buildings to the crosswalks. There's even a statue of Winston Churchill. I mean, it's really remarkable the kind of detail they go to, and there's no real hiding of it either. When they copied the Apple products, they didn't even change the names that significantly. In fact, the iPad became the iPad, and the iPhone became the iPhone. You know, these are kind of ways, I guess, of letting their consumers know that this is close to the original, but you'll actually get it for a lower price. And in some ways, you'll get a superior product, which I know is hard to believe, but the iPad actually had a camera installed on it before the iPad had one.
And what are the legal consequences of copying in China? Is there any legal redress? How strong is the IP world there?
Well, it's getting stronger, that's for sure. Just this last year, the American automaker Ford was able to block a copy of one of its trucks, which was an exact replica. I think it just depends on which side the Chinese government wants to side. If they want to make one of their large foreign investors very happy, they can certainly come down on the fake producer. Sometimes they don't seem to do that, though, and it'll be interesting whether this Zaha Hadid building will actually result in any kind of legal recourse.
Do we know what Dame Zaha's reaction has been?
Surprisingly, not very harsh. She actually said something about how this shows innovation at work in China, and it could be very exciting to see a copy of her designs, which is frankly very surprising. But, she might not be too worried since she has about a dozen other projects in China underway.
And that was Emma Nelson talking to Justin Bergman, our man in Singapore. You're listening to Midori House, and we're going to stay in China, more or less. And though we promise this isn't a bootleg, this is Meng Tian, the Swiss-Chinese singer-songwriter, not the Qin Dynasty general, with the appropriately titled Exactly the Same. That was Meng Tian with Exactly the Same. You're listening to Midori House, and in the next half hour of the program, we'll find out why San Francisco is now paying the highest minimum wage in the United States and ask what help a Ferris wheel is to an island recovering from catastrophe.
I get 2 to 2.5 million visitors, tourists that come each and every year and never get off the ferry. I need to attract them to something here that they can't get anyplace else in the country.
What a fabulous accent. But before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. An international human rights and medical organization has warned today of a silent crisis in the Central African Republic as people in the capital, Bangui, nervously wait to see if the advancing rebels reach their city. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez is suffering from complications brought on by a severe lung infection, which developed after surgery, officials have said today. Mr. Chavez had his fourth operation for cancer in Cuba on the 11th of December and then developed a respiratory infection. Italian police have arrested a young mafia boss in Naples. Antonio Manetta is considered to be the boss of the Gerati, a group of the Neapolitan Camorra mafia. Nepal held its eighth day of anti-rape protests today in a movement that has mirrored neighbouring India and is demanding protection against rape. And members of a British team were today getting ready to fly to Burma to search for MK-14 Spitfires, believed to have been buried at the end of the Second World War. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio 2 in London. Now, 10 states in America kicked off the new year with a minimum wage rise of between 10 and 35 cents, modestly boosting GDP and the incomes of nearly a million low-paid workers. San Francisco's minimum rate rose to $10.55 an hour, overtaking Santa Fe as America's highest minimum wage. In general, the increases should put an extra $190 to $510 a year into the pocket of the average minimum wage worker. But how do these rises work, and why aren't they happening in all US states? Well, joining me now is Paul Son, who's a legal co-director at the National Employment Law Project in New York. First of all, Paul, the increase is obviously a good thing to people on the minimum wage, but how easy is it to live in San Francisco on $10.55 an hour?
Hi there. Well, it's actually not easy at all, as you can imagine. I mean, it's San Francisco, like New York, where I'm based, is a very high cost of living city, and even $10 and change an hour is really not nearly enough to rent an apartment, even if you have two people in a household earning at that level. but it's a good deal better than the minimum wage is elsewhere in the United States. You know, the U.S. minimum wage would be about that level, about 10-15 hour, if it had kept pace with inflation over the last 40 years. But instead, at the national level, it's just $7.25, not very much at all.
Well, before we examine that further, give us a bit of background, if you will. Explain how the minimum wage system in the U.S. works.
So in the U.S., there is a federal minimum wage, which is the national minimum wage, and it is adjusted by Congress, but it does not automatically increase. And unlike, I believe, you have in the U.K., we do not have a low-pay commission that can recommend, you know, adjustments each year or every few years. It literally takes an act of Congress to pass a new statute to raise the minimum wage. And unfortunately, the minimum wage, you know, partly because of the role of money in our political system by lobbying by low-wage industries, the minimum wage has become a political football, and Washington has not raised it very regularly in past years. The 2007 increase in the minimum wage was the first one in 10 years. Before that, it was 1997 during the Clinton administration when the minimum wage was last raised, and before that, there've been quite a number of years as well. So it's really the Congress in Washington have not been doing their job of updating the minimum wage, and so it's fallen to the states. And in our federal system, each state and in some states, even cities, can enact higher minimum wages. And many of the states have, and a number of cities have enacted higher minimum wages, especially high cost of living cities like San Francisco. And so 10 of those states have adopted annual cost of living increase laws, where the minimum wage is adjusted each January to keep up with the rising cost of living. And that's a model policy that we would like to see Congress enact. And President Obama has endorsed raising the U.S. minimum wage and then adjusting it each year for inflation, as those states do. And we're hopeful that in the coming Congress, the president and legislative leaders will push for that. There was a strong bill introduced by Senator Tom Harkin and Representative George Miller calling for that and calling to raise the U.S. minimum wage to approximately $10 an hour. So we're hopeful that there will be action on that sometime in the coming year or two.
Is there any suggestion or any evidence that in those states and cities which have decided to raise their own minimum wages, that they've benefited from that, that it's been good for the local economy, or whether it's attracted more people to the city or things like that? Is it a good thing for places to do?
We believe it is. We believe both the recent research and really the economic research on the minimum wage has really changed. The consensus view has changed substantially over the past 15 years, based on research done largely in the U.S. and in the U.K. Whereas, you know, you all, because the U.K. reinstated the minimum wage after it had been abolished under the Thatcher government, it really provided a good case study for looking at the impact. And the recent evidence shows very little impact at job loss resulting from minimum wage increases, and quite the contrary, you know, increases in living standards and in spending power by low-income families that actually help local economies. And a very vivid illustration of this, there was a New York Times story a couple years ago about the border between Washington State, which has the U.S.'s highest state minimum wage of about $9.20, in Idaho, which is a very rural state that where the minimum wage was approximately $3 lower, and just across the state line, a $3, you know, maybe must have been about a 35% difference in the minimum wage, maybe more. And it detailed how low-income workers were flocking to Washington State to, you know, work in McDonald's and Walmart jobs because they paid so much better, and that there was, you know, no evidence that businesses were relocating out across the state line out of Washington to avoid the higher minimum wage.
I just wanted to return to the subject you raised a couple of questions back about Congress's chain-dragging about raising the federal minimum wage in the United States. What are the possible objections to that? It seems an extraordinary thing for anybody to object to, the idea that the poorest workers in the country should be paid a little bit more.
Well, yeah, you make an excellent point, and with the voters, with the public, raising the minimum wage is overwhelmingly popular with voters of every political persuasion, Republican voters, independent voters, Democratic voters, they all strongly support raising the minimum wage. And when it goes to the ballot, in some states in the U.S., you can enact laws by voter ballot initiative. And when it's minimum wage is on the ballot, as it was in 2006, even in very conservative states like Montana and Arizona, it has passed overwhelmingly. But in Congress, in state legislatures, we unfortunately have this largely unregulated political system where individuals and businesses can contribute a lot of money to candidates, and that really skews our political process. And we believe that's a lot of the explanation for why Congress has not done its job in updating the minimum wage. I mean, the opponents, like the restaurant industry, claim that it kills jobs. But as I noted, the best research in recent years really shows that that's not at all the case.
Paul Son, legal co-director at the National Employment Law Project in New York, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We will be back right after this with a baffled gawp into our crystal ball.
Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
It's 18:39 here in London and you're listening to Midori House. Now, here is a fun parlour game. Think of a few things generally regarded as perfectly acceptable, reasonable and civilised behaviour right now, which might, just a few decades on, be regarded as incomprehensibly backward and barbarous, on a par, say, with denying women the vote, or permitting smoking in underground trains, or prosecuting homosexuality as a crime, all of which have been norms in first world countries within living memory. Then consider how many opinions you might have held personally years or decades ago that you now regard as ignorant or idiotic, and wonder how many of the tastes and principles you currently treasure and defend which might seem just as inexplicable or silly a little further down the track. It's not easy, which explains why most of us prefer not to think about it. A team of Harvard psychologists who studied 19,000 people aged 18 to 68 call this the end of history illusion. While we recognise that we've changed, we imagine we'll stay the same. Well, joining me now is Jordi Quadbach, a researcher at Harvard University and one of the authors of the paper. Jordi, what surprised you most about this research?
What really struck me was that not only does it happen for teenagers, it's totally obvious that a teenager thinks his preference for loud music will remain the same forever, but it also happens for middle-aged adults and for older adults. So at all ages, it seems we feel like we reach the peak of our personal evolution.
So we're just all kind of in love with the idea that the person we are now is the best we've ever been.
Exactly. It's like we can look back on our lives and realize that our preferences might not have been wise, or that our values might not have been the right ones, but we're unable to imagine that they will change in the future. Problem is, they will change in the future.
I mean, or is it conversely just because we don't like the idea that everybody's just making this up as they go along and that no one's really got any idea what they're doing?
So it might be a comforting belief that we're done changing, that we're stable for the rest of our lives. Actually, research shows that it's not the case. Personality change across the lifespan. Obviously, values and preferences change too. So we might have these beliefs to make us feel better, but it leads us to make poor decisions.
What might be, I mean, there must be reasons hardwired into us somewhere for this resistance to the idea that we're going to change. What might be the evolutionary reasons for that?
Maybe the evolutionary reason is that it helped us decide, right? If I could envision that my preferences are totally transient, then I might not invest money, let's say, in buying a house, or I might not invest resources into a relationship because I know my preferences and women might change. So I think at some point, this illusion might help us decide. The problem is, like any cognitive biases, if it's helpful in one hand, it might also be detrimental with the other hand. And in this case, it could lead us to make suboptimal decisions regarding our future happiness.
I mean, how much of the phenomenon do you think might be down to the concept of sunk costs, you know, that reluctance we have to walk away from things we've invested in or in which we've invested in one shape or form, however stupidly?
It could be one of the mechanisms. So far, we have a few ideas about the mechanism, but we don't have data to prove it. We think there is, first, a motivational reason. We like to think of our preferences, whys, and our values very important, and therefore, we don't want to see them changing. The second reason might be cognitive. Humans have a very hard time at imagining the future, and therefore, we know from past research that when something is hard to imagine, we infer it is also unlikely, which is totally wrong.
I mean, did you exclusively study Americans? I'm wondering if you think this might be different in different cultures.
So actually, the sample here was mainly French people, Belgians, and Swiss people.
Okay.
It was a European sample, and I do believe this illusion is universal, but I obviously need to test it further. It might have differences with, let's say, Asian cultures. We know in psychology there's a lot of differences sometimes between Western and Eastern cultures. But it seems like a pretty robust phenomenon from what I could see.
What do you think might be different about life on this Earth if we weren't, or if we were able to see past this or rise above it and acknowledge to ourselves the possibility that we might change radically in the future?
I think we might allow us a little more flexibility in the way we decide things. So we might decide to get a tattoo with removable ink, or we might decide to rent before buying this big condo, these kind of things. I think realizing that our preferences are not going to be the same forever, or personality is going to change, help us be a little more flexible in what we decide.
Jordi Quadbuck, researcher at Harvard University, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. While it may be difficult to imagine the destruction and upheaval caused by a natural disaster of the scale of Superstorm Sandy, which struck America's east coast in November, it's not difficult to imagine what the victims might need most. Shelter, clothes, blankets, food, government assistance to rebuild their communities, and so forth. Rather lower down the list of priorities for the soggy-socked survivors, you would think would be an enormous Ferris wheel. Nevertheless, that's what the people of Staten Island, at least, can look forward to. Though many islanders are still waiting to return to their homes, the half-billion-dollar project known as the New York Wheel is going ahead. When complete late in 2015, the 682-foot attraction will be the biggest Ferris wheel in the world, offering views of the Statue of Liberty and Lower Manhattan, as well as, its backers argue, a much-needed fillip to the economy of an often overlooked borough. But, the private nature of the enterprise notwithstanding, is this really what Staten Island needs most right now? Earlier, I put exactly that question to James Molinaro, president of Staten Island Borough.
It's completely different priorities. One doesn't take away from the other. So it would be the same amount of priority that would be given if Sandy didn't happen at all.
Has the fact that Sandy did happen, though, changed people's attitudes about building a 682-foot Ferris wheel?
Well, I haven't heard any of that, other than two or three people that were opposed to the wheel from the original notification of it, that were afraid that the wheel might fall down.
Has the fact of the storm and the surge caused any modifications to be made to the design?
I don't believe so. If there's any modifications have been made, I've not been notified of it.
Okay. Well, the wheel is due to open late 2015, as I understand it, so it's obviously a fairly big project. What benefits do you think it will bring to Staten Island?
Let's look at what we have in Staten Island right now. Let's start with New York City. New York City last year received 52 million visitors from all over the world, about 20% from overseas and about 80% from the United States themselves. Out of those 52 million, they spent $36 billion in purchases and staying at hotels in New York City. I have a very connection between Manhattan and Staten Island, which goes right by the Staten Island, the Statue of Liberty. I get 2 to 2.5 million visitors, tourists that come each and every year and ride that ferry back and forth and never get off the ferry.
I'm afraid to say I've done exactly that myself.
Okay. So now I need to attract them to something here that they can't get anyplace else in the country. They could go to England, of course, but it's a lot cheaper when you're in Staten Island or in New York City to go across and get on a wheel, which you have to go to London or Australia or Hong Kong or Singapore. So I think I'll be able to attract them to stay here. Along with that wheel that we are building, we're also building in a big outlet center with a hotel, and right down the road, meaning about less than a half a mile away, there's another hotel being built, which gives you the greatest view in the world. It gives you the view of New York City at night with the lights on. It's just absolutely gorgeous. I know, because my office faces the same way. And people will be staying in hotels on Staten Island and paying half the price they would pay in Manhattan for the same hotel with a better view. And that would be bringing money into the community. Would be hiring people from my community. Would be a game changer for Staten Island.
Returning to Staten Island at ground level as it is now, how is the recovery from Sandy going, I guess, a little less than 2 months later?
Very, very slowly. Very slowly. There's a lot of problems. You have to realize that we have a situation where I have 25,000 homes that are built below sea level. So they get flooded out with a normal rain. It's a slow process. These are homes that were built in the 30s and 40s that should have never been built there.
And so in terms of the rebuilding and the clear-up, are you proceeding on the assumption that Sandy was a fluke, or that there will be more extreme weather events like that one and rethinking the rebuilding accordingly?
You have to rebuild accordingly to the new rules that are coming out, the new flood zone rules, which will be out the 17th of January from the federal government. And that means that you may have to put your house on stilts, 2 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet high off the ground. You may have to. If you want to build, that's what you have to do. But the existing homes are still in danger.
And how much, I mean, are you getting all the assistance you think you need from the state and federal governments?
I have no complaints at this time. At this time, I have no complaints. This is an event that's happened, hasn't happened for 100 years. In fact, we had a gentleman whose house was destroyed. He was 102 years old. And I asked him, one evening when I met him at a banquet, I asked him, I said, how long have you been living there? He says, I've been living there since I'm 9 years old. So he's been living there 93 years. He's been living there. And he said, did you ever see anything like this? He says, no. We got some flooding in the basement once in a while. He says, but nothing like this at all. So it could be a 100-year storm. And there is such a thing as a 100-year storm when all the conditions are just right.
That's the difficulty, I guess, is knowing whether to rebuild in the assumption that the next storm won't be for another 100 years or whether the same thing might happen again next year.
That's right. That's right. That's a gamble. But if you do rebuild, you have to rebuild under the new guidelines, which are established by the Federal Flood Insurance Company, Insurance Department.
You believe personally, as stepping down in December after 3 terms in office as borough president, how do you think Staten Island has changed during that time? Do you think it's become, you were talking a bit earlier about how it's slightly neglected by tourists, do you think it's becoming less so?
Well, no, there's been some big changes made. We're a bedroom, we're still a bedroom community. We don't have that much industry or manufacturing out here. I did create a paper mill. I was able to attract a paper mill, and I was able to discourage a large chocolate-producing company from moving down to North Carolina, down to the South, because of tax reasons. And they just expanded, and they have a big employment. I have the largest container port in New York State right here on Staten Island. So we do have some industry, but what we did do is that we made some really, really big changes in our building code on Staten Island, which would reduce we reduced the full capacity of Staten Island. If it was built out completely, it would create 75,000 less homes from being built.
As I was saying earlier, the Ferris wheel is projected to open a little over two years from now. So that's a while to wait. In the meantime, if I or anybody listening to this was coming to New York, what's your favorite reason to visit Staten Island?
There's many places of interest here. We have a great zoo here. We have a conference house park, shooting ranges. We have a number of stables. We have that. We have almost anything you want.
And that was James Molinari, the president of Staten Island Borough. You're listening to Midori House, and we're staying on Staten Island, or at least with one of Staten Island's most famous daughters. This is Christina Aguilera with Genie in a Bottle.
Come on and let me out.
Staten Island's own Christina Aguilera with Genie in a Bottle. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres,
Holanda,
London,
London으로부터
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. This is Midori House, or rather that was Midori House, because that's all we have time for on today's show. Thanks very much to our producers Marcus Hippie and Hannah Jenkins, our researchers Pilar Lopez and Emily Aylett, and our studio manager Chris Fitch. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Menu. Today they go over the show's best moments of the year, which include Joseph Dana, who we heard earlier, searching the Middle East for the origins of hummus. Midori House will return at the same time on Monday, and I'll be back tomorrow at midday for the review with Emma Nelson. But until then, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.